Thank you, Andy. Hi, everyone. My name is Shay Meddings, and I'm the host of the Mental as Anyone podcast. I'm a psychologist, and I interview comedians and other entertainers about their mental health with the aim of helping to increase understanding and awareness of mental health. I've had some really insightful and interesting conversations, including with Andy, and I encourage you to have a listen. So find Mental as Anyone through the Facebook page, on iTunes or other podcasting platforms. Stay safe and well.
Hey, welcome to the Antisocial Podcast. And before we kick into this week's episode, come over and join me on Patreon. Patreon.com/AndyDowling is the place to go if you want to support this little old podcast of mine. Support starts from only $1 a month, dirt cheap, and there are additional tiers if you want to get access to exclusive goodies. Patreon.com/AndyDowling. Thank you very much. Episode 233, I think. Yeah, that'll do. Episode 233 of the Antisocial Podcast is here. This week's guest is Casey Martin Stone. Casey is an archaeologist, a comedian, all the way from Darwin, up in the top end of Australia. And as Casey would say, chaser of the fun stuff. You can go to caseymonica.com, or you can also follow her on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching Casey Martin Stone. And I'll have everything in the show notes, of course, over at andydowling.net or andysocial.net. And hopefully, by the time this episode comes out, you should be able to pre-order her special called I See Dead People on her website. If it's not available yet, then I will update the show notes in due course. So make sure you go and check all that out. But great chat. I've known Casey for quite a few years, right from the first time Lord played in Darwin, which would have been well and truly over a decade ago, I think. My memory's a little bit hazy, but yeah, great person, great chat. We spoke about dead people, of course, her profession being an archaeologist, comedy being a comedian, and a heap of other stuff. There you go. Great English. And now, if you're from Darwin, I don't know how many Darwin listeners are listening to this, but there you go. Welcome aboard if you're new to the podcast. But Darwin listeners, you can check out Casey at the Darwin Festival on the 11th of August. I have no idea if it's sold out yet, but go and check it out if you can, and support a great person, great comedian, great archaeologist. Yeah, why not? But yeah, here we go. Here's my chat with Casey Martin Stone, CaseyMonica.com, Casey Martin Stone on the socials, AndySocial.net, AndyDowling.net. Shut up, Andy. Here we go. Casey.
Well, yeah, it's really interesting because I'm at the moment trying to restart or reinstall a daily routine and finding it really difficult. I've been sick for nearly 2.5 years. I have had a constant migraine for that time.
Oh, wow.
And I took 4 months off work when it was at its worst in 2018, and then I've been working part-time since July 2018. Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say, have you, I mean, I know you said that for the last couple of years, but have you always had sort of migraines sort of coming and going over time?
No, not like this. Oh, I've previously had a couple of chronic migraines 20 years ago, and we later found out it's because I'm allergic to general anaesthetic. So I'd had surgery and then afterwards had a migraine that lasted 10 months. And because my migraine, I'm very lucky, my migraines come without pain usually. But because of that, they weren't diagnosed as migraines for quite a long time. So, yeah, it's sort of hit January 2018 as a result of burnout and other things. And the beautiful thing about being self-employed and working from home is that you have endless flexibility. And so if I didn't feel capable of working one day, I wouldn't have to. But the downside of that is that you lose the routine. And so now, as my health is bouncing back, I'm finding it really important. I'm reading a book about how to sleep properly and and just trying to get set into a routine where, as you say, you get up and you do your thing because that's what you do, and then everything just unfolds as it should.
I won't spend too much time on this, but you just mentioned before with the migraine thing that it didn't bring pain. And this is like a really silly thing for me to ask, but I guess I've always associated, I mean, I've never had a migraine in my life. I've had headaches. But I would always assume that a migraine would be something that would have pain attached to it. So what's the general feeling that you've, I mean, because for something to linger for that long, I'm just thinking, oh my God, how did you even survive?
Oh, yeah, it's weird. So it does come with occasional pain, and migraine pain is like you're being stabbed in the head with a screwdriver. So it's funny. And migraine symptoms change over time, and I go to my monthly review appointment with my GP, and last time I went to see her, I said, oh, I had this stabbing pain. I thought I was going to pass out. Like, it hit me as I was stepping into the shower, and I'd only turned the hot tap on, and I, thought I was going to pass out, stumbled into the wall, and managed to stay upright and turn the cold tap on. And she said, okay, noted, nothing we can do about the pain. Just make sure you turn the cold tap on before you step in the shower. Great. Okay. I've got all these, little management tips now. But the symptoms for my migraine can be fairly standard across other people's migraines. They call mine severe migraine with neurological manifestations. And so migraine aura is when you have vision disturbance and language disturbance and cognitive disturbance. So I get short-term memory loss. I got lost in the toilet one day. I was standing there going, am I on my way in or my way out? Couldn't tell.
That could have been disastrous.
I know, right? And so short-term memory loss is pretty bad, and the inability to focus and everything that brings. And vision disturbances, sparkling lights, flashing lights. My vision changed. I'm now quite short-sighted, but that changes as the severity of my days go. Language was interesting. Slur your words, get a stutter, that sort of a thing. I also lose my social filters, so I call complete strangers a dickhead in the post office and things like that. I know. As I was getting really sick in 2018, I was hospitalised for 10 days, and I rang the general manager of a client company. So he's like the Australian general manager of a multinational, and was talking to him about the fact that I needed to revise deadlines. And you could tell that he wanted to ask what was wrong with me, but didn't feel he could. And so I volunteered and, like, I've got severe migraines. And we were talking about it, and he's like, oh, so that must really affect your work. And I'm like, oh, no, I'm still an occasionally competent motherfucker. And I told my GP about that, and she's like, you have to stop work. Like, you are going to burn bridges.
It's like a ticking time bomb.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so there's all of those symptoms, and there's muscle spasms so hard I shattered my teeth, sensation of ants crawling on my skin, which was constant for 18 months and then has been intermittent, and, just neurological shit, basically.
That's amazing.
And so it's weird because it's invisible. Yeah. And
I think most people would be very ignorant to it. And, I mean, there's one person I know really well, Simone, who plays in the Perth band Voyager, and she's been on the podcast, and I've known her for so long, but she's always had migraines for as long as I've known her, and it's been a really big part of her life, and she talks about it quite a bit and how much it controls what she does. And, you know, there's times where she's on tour and things like that, and she just has to hide away because it's just it's just so controlling.
Lie in a dark room under a weighted blanket.
But she talks about it in a way that, and this is where the ignorance from my side comes into it, because she talks about it in a way where she's trying to bring awareness to the topic, and she's really passionate about it, of course. But I've always sort of looked at it as just thinking, well, it must be just some sort of crippling headache.
Really bad headache.
And that's about it. But even just what you've explained, it sounds like there's just so many variations of what a migraine is. And for most people, if you're talking to an employer or just friends and family, they're just thinking, well, just sounds like you've just got a bad headache or something like that, and you need a day rest, and that's about it. But obviously it can be far worse than that. So it's just amazing just to hear sort of your experience with it, because I've never known.
Yeah, it's kind of weird and it's very frustrating because I love my brain and I've always defined myself by my brain. Like I'm a smart, competent person who does interesting things. And to have that temporarily disabled, it calls into question all sorts of things. When I was hospitalised for that first 10 days, my specialist would come every day and review. It felt like I was going nuts. And I remember him saying something. I said, look, I'm supposed to be advising the minister on a multi-million dollar problem here, and I'm lying in hospital fucking up craft for 10-year-olds. And he said, you seem a little anxious. Do you think you might have anxiety? And I'm like, of course I'm fucking anxious. My fucking brain doesn't work.
Thanks for pointing that out. Really helpful.
Yeah. I don't think I have fucking anxiety. But there's so much of that. It's such a misunderstood condition. People are like, maybe it's nothing. Maybe it's anxiety.
Do you think that there's many people out there that have some of these symptoms but just haven't quite worked out what it is? Because even just some of those things that you've explained, I see people day to day that just act, you know, just have these little odd moments, and you can see people are sort of naturally tense and stressed, and you can see they're uncomfortable, and maybe it might not be this in particular, but it could be anything that they're just not aware of.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And a lot of it, I mean, the brain is a super complex beast, and a lot of the symptoms that I experience are also experienced by people with chronic stress and depression and anxiety and other physical conditions of the brain as well. And so it's really difficult to put a label on things, and particularly if your symptoms seem just a little bit weird. Like I had numb patches on my skin, on my forehead and my parts of my arms, not my whole arm. And you're like, how does that even work physiologically? And so the sensation of ants crawling on your skin is called formication, which sounds like fun, but it's not. And you wouldn't think, women often when they hit menopause and perimenopause get really dry, itchy skin, and that's related as well. So it's the way your brain processes things. But what essentially happens with my migraine and a lot of stress-related conditions is that your brain is primed in that fight, flight, or freeze response. If you imagine a glass full of water, that level of anticipation of threat is usually quite low in the glass. And if you have it increased, it's still contained within the glass. But when you've got a stress-related or chronic stress condition, that baseline level of threat response is quite high and it doesn't take much to trip it over. And so that's why you see people under chronic stress getting cranky and snapping at the smallest thing and that sort of thing. It's not something that they can necessarily help, and it's just the brain's way of reacting. And so, yeah, it's a really strange thing. I tend to now try and notice adrenaline and alertness and cortisol and how my brain is active, because I know that a short period of very active brain requires some chill time afterwards. And so, yeah, it's tricky to manage.
Oh, absolutely. And I would assume that part of your personality is that you're a little bit introverted as well, which probably means that you're...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so if you're doing a lot of social interaction and you're out there with a lot of stimulus, you need to recover and regain that energy again before you can go out and do the same thing over and over again.
Absolutely, peopling. I had to take a year off comedy in 2018 because I couldn't handle lights, noise or people. Oh. And yeah, that's kind of what comedy is. Mm. And so coming back to the other really interesting thing about the migraine was that I lost the ability to recognise a joke.
Oh, right.
And, yeah, the reason for that is migraine or chronic stress or depression or anxiety, shrink your hippocampus, your rational thinking part of your brain, and it grows the amygdala, the emotional response, the fight, flight, freeze response, and it breaks the connections between the two. And so jokes happen in that space between thoughts and feelings. And when that's gone, I just couldn't recognize jokes. And I remember maybe about 14 months in, my doctor said to me, "I can tell you're getting better now." And I said, "How can you tell?" And she said, "You just laughed at my first joke in over a year."
Must have been a good one.
Yeah. Oh, she tells some pretty bad jokes. She's not that good at it. Yeah, wow. But it's nice. So, yeah, and that's one of the ways I can tell I'm having a bad day is that I take things at very literally. So there was a guy on Twitter talking about statues and horses, et cetera, and if they had one leg lifted or two legs lifted, maybe it meant something. And I'm like, well, actually it does. Like, one leg lifted means that they were wounded in battle, and two legs lifted means they died in battle. And he's like, "Yes, that was the joke. Thanks for explaining it for me." And I'm like, oh, fuck. My profile says Casey Martin Stone, archaeologist, comedian. Fuck.
I know people on a day-to-day basis, and that's their life. They never pick up on a joke whatsoever, and they're always very, very literal with their responses. And there's been so many times over the years I'm like, yes, that's what we're trying to get to. Thank you very much for spelling that out. Very, very, very helpful. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and it is just the way the brains are wired sometimes. Mm. And so for me, I find that really strange when I switch between the two, because obviously I tell jokes for a living and I understand how they work, but sometimes they just go over my head. It's so weird because when you're in the moment, you're like, oh, this is a fact. I know that fact. And you want to share it, you know, because I'm a smart person. And then you're like, oh, fuck, I was supposed to be a funny person.
It's that time and the place scenario where you've got to make it hit in the context of the situation, which is, I don't always hit that, that's for sure.
Absolutely, yeah. It's part of those social filters as well, is recognizing what's going on around you. And, yeah. It was so weird when my doctor told me I had lost my social filters. I went, oh, that makes sense. Because it was really distressing for me when I was in the hospital. One of the nurses went to hug me, which I don't know whether that's the normal thing they do. But I just screamed no and climbed backwards over a chair. Yeah, like I was just like, don't fucking touch me. And I was so distressed about that because I didn't know why I was doing it. And it's not me. Like, I don't scream at nurses. Nurses are the most fucking amazing people in our society. And I was just like, don't fucking touch me. I wouldn't let them make my bed because they'd make it wrong. The wrinkles in the sheets would fuck up my skin. So, like, just leave them there and I'll do it myself. I was not a good patient then. It's awful.
It's just—it's almost like this hypersensitive awareness of everything going around, but to the point where it's irrational as far as normal social situations and social cues. You've just taken everything, like all these things, to the extreme in order to sort of, you know, what you feel at the moment is protecting yourself against what you might feel is danger of on multiple levels.
Absolutely. Everything was stimulus and it was overwhelming. Mm. So up to that point in time, I had been gradually declining in health and not really knowing what was wrong and pushing myself harder and collapsing on the couch and lying in the dark all day. And then my specialist said, I'll put you into hospital and we'll try this medication or run these tests. And the hospital environment was something I had no control over. And so I had a private room with a bathroom that had a fluorescent light on automatic. When you opened the door, it turned on, and I couldn't cope with that. The window had vertical blinds and it overlooked a courtyard with palm trees in it. And it was April, which is when the wet season changes to the dry season here. We have winds called the knock-em-downs. And so these winds were blowing the palm fronds, and the light that reflected off those leaves was like a fucking disco ball on the back of my eyelids. And So, yeah, everything was just too much for my brain to take in. And then if anyone was going to touch me in that time or have wrinkles in the sheets or whatever, I was just like, I can't cope. So, yeah.
Intense.
No wonder I was telling my clients I was an occasionally competent motherfucker. I'm not sure how competent I was.
It's just this,
certainly shouldn't have been at work.
Oh, God. It's just this, as you said before, that sort of increasing level of that tipping point where just you're always on the verge of just it all just spilling over and just falling apart and just constantly being on edge just because of everything going on around you. It's very interesting because it's just something that I've certainly not I certainly haven't personally experienced myself and just haven't really sort of had the awareness of it. So it's interesting just to get your side of it. But I mean, what you said before, like you're getting to a point now where you're starting to get better and starting to sort of go back to whatever normal looks like these days. But I guess with everything that's been happening in the world over the past few months, it's probably been a bit of a blessing in disguise, so to speak, just to give you just that little bit of extra time just to go through that sort of tail end of recovery.
I wish it was, but it hasn't been.
Oh, okay.
So,
well then,
I am waiting for that day. Now things are opening up here, and I'm like, I'm not ready. it's been really, really strange. So I was having a brilliant year. I did my second comedy solo show called I See Dead People. I did a sold out run in January in Darwin, and then 2 weeks at Adelaide Fringe in February, and I was just on the verge of taking it to Melbourne International Comedy Festival, which cancelled a few days out. And so when I did it in Adelaide, I got picked up by six new festivals and clubs and had booked a tour of Europe for August and September. And everything was just flying, you know. And I'm very lucky. I haven't lost those opportunities. They're just deferred till next year. But when it hit, well, I'd been working with clients since January to reduce the impact of coronavirus on Indigenous people in the territory, because I do a lot of my work in remote areas with Indigenous people. And so we'd been watching it and putting in contingency plans. And then in mid-March, when the biosecurity zones were announced and all the borders closed, I just lost 100% of all of my upcoming work. And so I still had three reports to finish, but they weren't time critical. And then suddenly there were all of these grant opportunities that you had to apply for. And so I've applied for 10 grants and finished two of the reports, and I have to finish the third one this week, and they won't be paid until July. And so, yeah, it's been this mad scramble, but also the increased stress fled the migraine. So this was a really interesting thing. No, I know, it's so weird. I was on Botox for 15 months because it has a surprise side effect of helping migraines, and it didn't fix it, but it did reduce the severity of it. And then I came off that in December and started a new medication, which is amazing. It's called a CGRP, calcitonin gene-related peptide medication, and these are the first ones developed specifically for migraine. And so I injected myself with three shots in January and was to repeat that quarterly. And that was starting to work its way out of my system as all of the stress increased. So it was the perfect storm for the migraine to come back. So the right side of my face fell like a stroke victim. So now it's invisible. And so, yeah, I just kind of regressed at least a year in the migraine. So I've kind of lost half my time to migraine, and the other half the time I've spent doing grant applications and shit. And I feel like I'll be able to breathe the first week of July. So it hasn't been as ideal as I'd like it to be. I still haven't confirmed the cash flow I need, but I know that's not far away. So, yeah, then, and the other thing too, though, is everything's ramping up now. So it went from lots of interstate companies lobbying the government to be exempted from their work requirements this year to them calling me last week going, what's your availability like for late August? So at the moment I'm pretty much booked up until mid-September, and I'm still waiting to hear back on projects I've got grant applications in for, so it could get very busy. I'll take the first week of July off.
I think at the very least, you give yourself a little bit of a space to breathe before diving back into it all. I mean, I'm noticing that everywhere with all sorts of different industries where, you know, people have been, you know, have been held back, you know, in more ways than one. And now as things begin to slowly ease and restrictions lifted in different ways, then it's almost like the floodgates are about to open. It's great in some ways, but in other ways, I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on people to catch up for lost time. That's going to add some other problems for individuals to just to manage this mentally, because it's going to be a very busy second half of the year, I think.
Oh, it really will. And it's something that I've had to consciously think about over the last couple of years, is managing how much I commit to, because I always want to do everything.
Yeah, me too.
I overcommit myself. So, like, I run two businesses, I do all these things, and I'm still looking to do more. And I had someone approach me about quoting for a really big job, and they asked me how much time I could give them from July till November. And I went, I really would like the money. The work will be interesting and fun. But how much time can I give? And if I commit that now, does that preclude me from doing all the other fun stuff I've sought funding for? And what do I say if that gets approved and I don't? And so it's this balance, but also right down to the daily level. I've started changing, and it gets back to that having a daily routine and getting up and going for your walk. And so I'm staging my goals over the rest of the year. So this quarter until the end of June, I want to do gentle exercise every day and manage 4 hours a day of work, 2 hours of deep focus tasks and 2 hours of shallow focus tasks. And then over Q1 and Q2 of the new financial year, add 2 hours of deep focus tasks each day. So by the end of the year, I should be back to working full time. So usually I'd go, I need to get fit. I'll run 10Ks. <You know? laughs> Whereas now it's like, I need to get fit. For 3 months, I'm just going to walk every day. I'll do yoga. Yep. Then I'll do the couch to 5K. And then I'll do the 10Ks.
That's a very good way of doing it. I think that's one thing I failed at miserably over the years, is, you know, you have this moment of inspiration or frustration where you go, I need to change my life. And you go from 0 to 100. Suddenly you've dropped everything. You go on some crazy diet, or you start exercising till it hurts, and it's just not sustainable. Mm. It's just you might get a week worth of good habits, and then it just all falls apart. And I just think just what you explained is just perfect, because it's just make it as easy as possible to win every day, and you gradually tweak it. And before you know it, you're doing a lot more than you ever thought you could. And it's just been a natural sort of progression in that direction.
Absolutely. I read a good book that really helped me. It was called Atomic Habits.
Oh, yes. I've got it in front of me.
There you go.
James Clear.
Mm. Yes. And that's like just that idea of improving 1%.
Yep.
Improve 1%. And over time, you'll be so much more capable. So, yeah, that's all new to me this year, but so far it seems to be having results.
That's good. Well, at least moving in a positive direction. And as you said, like, the structure of having a routine is so critical. So as long as you can keep the foundation in place, then everything else, there's a better chance that everything else will fall into place where it should. So, and especially if you get the curveball as well.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting what you said before about knowing people who have migraines but not knowing much about it. Mm. And I think it goes not just for migraine but lots of chronic conditions, is that people that have them, like me, don't want to put ourselves out in public as less than capable or affected, because we know that we can lose opportunities.
Yep.
By being honest. And so it's a really difficult balance. I'm at the point where I'm getting better, and I'm still, like, while I've had my migraine, 2 months into my migraine, I did my first solo show ever, comedy. And then while I've had the migraine, I've written my second solo show. And these are things that would challenge anybody, let alone somebody with a chronic migraine. So, yeah, it's you still have wins and you still have capability, and you just have to learn to work with it. But also I think letting people know what it's really like is important, because people now say to me, oh, I thought you were better. Like, are you still sick? And I'm like, yeah, it's just, I just deal with this. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting, because you certainly, I mean, I think that's why most people that have any kind of challenge are hesitant to talk about it, because, you know, you get put into a different light, and suddenly it's almost like the handicap gets placed on you as an individual. So then suddenly, you know, everybody's, you know, even if it's good intentions, people start to compromise because of you or make adjustments on your behalf and without your input or an opportunity for you to contribute, because people are sort of ultra sensitive to what's going on in your life. And so as a result, a lot of people sort of keep the door closed, and that's a challenge in itself as well, and causes other issues. So it's a real juggling act to try and make sure that it's being talked about and people know, but at the same time ensuring that people, I don't know, can allow you to still live and do normal things and just get on with stuff.
And build my career and take these opportunities you know, still be willing to take a risk on me. And I mean, having said all of that, I know I am still incredibly lucky and incredibly privileged, because I have the ability to live this life, and some people have much worse challenges, much more difficult challenges than I do. So I don't want it to be a massive pity party. But, yeah, it's an interesting life. But I guess the migraine's probably I think of the migraine as one of the least interesting things about me these days. But
here we are, like, spending a lot of time on it, and just it's become a migraine podcast.
It has, but you know what's really interesting is that I also tend to think that archaeology's boring. I think because I don't find it as freshly interesting as I did 25 years ago, it's just become routine for me, and I forget how amazing and fascinating people find it. So I think I need to make space for that too,
Absolutely. Are you still the only archaeologist and comedian out there?
In Australia?
That you know of? Yeah.
I am in Australia, but there's five of us worldwide.
Have you got a little community that you all interact with?
Yeah, we do, actually. There's one, Paul Duncan McGarity in the UK. He has a podcast called Ask an Archaeologist, and I've been a guest on that one. And I was so looking forward to going to Edinburgh this year for the festival, because I was going to meet him in person for the first time. Yeah, but so, yeah, there's lots of really cool stuff happening out there in the world, and lots more I want to do. So, yeah, it's nice to have a community of people who are all creating fun stuff. I think when I grew up, there was this idea that life was a competition, and that you had to treat people doing your thing with caution, because they might take the opportunities that you wished for. And I don't subscribe to that anymore. It's like that feminist philosophy of a rising tide raises all boats.
Absolutely.
You know, I do my thing, and if people like it, then there's more opportunity for others to do their thing. And if they're doing their thing and people like it, then there's more opportunity for me. So
it's the same in music as well. I think, you know, years and years ago, where your channels in general in life were limited, so you only had you know, several pathways that you could take with a number of gatekeepers. You had those limited opportunities. So, you know, people tended to be a lot more competitive and cutthroat about trying to get their foot in the door with whatever that might be. And these days, I mean, we're so interconnected with everybody, not even just in our local area, but just all over the world. And so it's easy to carve out your own community of people that like you and what you do and your own unique spin on it, your own voice. I mean, even though you might have very similar overarching branding to what you do as far as the topics that you're interested in, the type of work that you do, mm-hmm. you're still unique compared to everybody else that does it, that's in the same space as well. So it's so easy to really create a following and an audience. So in music, we constantly tell each other, we look after each other and mm-hmm. we prop each other up. And the more that we do that and we think about each other rather than just ourselves, the better it is. I mean, the more opportunities come down the track as well. So it's a very sort of counterintuitive way of acting as opposed to what it used to be, even 5 or 10 years ago.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I think there are still some people who haven't caught on to that model, the new model. But overall, the best things happen in collaboration.
Mm.
And so getting out there and doing cool things with interesting people is one of my favourite things in the world. So, yeah, and it's interesting too when you say about doing what you do and knowing that there is an audience for you somewhere. It's really helped me in my comedy writing and to be able to develop my own practice by just saying, what do I think and what is it that only I can say about this subject? Because it means that while I'm influenced and inspired by a whole range of performers and academics, I'm doing my own thing. And so that for me has been really good in my writing and performing. But I think I'm still learning about the whole how to connect to the audience phase of things and, celebrating and sharing that thing that we all love together. One of the great things I've noticed, because I've started to track my audience this year, is the demographics breakdown and who likes what I'm putting out there. And I think I've got like 73% women in my audience, and the bulk of them are aged between 25 and 45. But there are niche interest groups in there, and it's people that like true crime and roller derby and heavy metal. Yeah. So
what a mix.
It's awesome. Yeah. And then I've got like doctors and nurses and funeral home people and teachers. And it's great. I love my crowd.
One thing that I've always had a challenge with, and I still do, I get really inspired by other people. So I'll see other people doing podcasts or musicians or whatever it might be. And there's a default reaction that I get instantly. And I think that is the framework, or that is the way that you need to be successful. And it changes all the time. Every single person, it's a completely different personality, the way they approach it. But the first thing that registers in my head is that's the blueprint. And then I start to think that what I'm doing in comparison to that is completely different. So then I go, oh geez, like what am I doing? Like, is this even working? Like, do I need to up the ante? Do I need to change my personality in the way that I put everything out there? And then, I go through
that's
this.
That's a very familiar thought.
Oh, yeah. And I go through these steps, and it's a reoccurring thing. And then eventually I get to the point where I go, no, it's okay, because that person's completely different to the person that you were obsessing about 24 hours ago. And the one that was, 3 days ago was completely different again. Everybody's different and everybody's exciting and has their own unique spin and voice and take on things. Mm-hmm. And what I'm doing is just another take again. So it's one of those things where I think it's just something that's just embedded in each of us, where we size ourselves up and we compare, and it's such a destructive thing if you're not aware of it and you default into it and you stay in that zone for a long period of time. So
absolutely,
the analytics of a lot of these pages, where you can see your audience and you can start to see their ages, gender and background and interests, etc. It's kind of cool, because it validates that There's humans out there that like what you do. Like they enjoy paying attention to whatever you've got to say or whatever you do and whatever you put out into the world. And then I think that sort of is that nice reassurance where you go, I have my crowd, like my community of people.
Absolutely.
And I can just keep doing my thing and just naturally go in that direction.
I think that's been incredibly reassuring and validating for me, having come from a small town where I felt like an outsider, where I was different to everybody else and criticized for being different. And it's the same now. I mean, I've been living in Darwin for nearly 20 years, but it's a small town compared to lots of other places. And you think, well, what I do, there's not enough of an audience here for me to have a local career in comedy. And so just knowing that there is this online world where people who like what I do can find me is really reassuring. It's nice to know that I don't have to dim myself down or shape myself a certain way to appeal to the masses. I've never wanted to appeal to the masses. But if I do my thing and find ways to connect with my audience, they will be there. So the plan I have is take a week off at the beginning of July and really think about what I'm doing and then actually put together a strategy, because there are so many things I want to do. I want to make videos for YouTube, podcasts, blogs, you know, use social media a little bit more strategically, I guess. But I realize that's a full-time job in itself, you know. So I've also got plans for the next solo show I'm writing and touring and all of that sort of thing. So it all has to be sustainable and it all has to feel authentically me. I don't want to feel like I'm following somebody else's blueprint.
Oh, absolutely. And I think giving yourself that time to sit back without any other expectations in front of you, where you can start to think a little bit wider about what you want to do, what actually makes sense to you personally in your own framework, can be a huge advantage. And I think also just going back to that whole atomic habits concept, even if you decide that you're going to go down a different path and add more to your space and to your world, and it's all about remaining sustainable and drip feeding things in. So you might decide that you want to, you know, get to a point where you're doing a whole heap of new and exciting things, but to get to that point, it's going to be about, well, what do I do each day that's minor and micro in nature, and then gradually builds in that direction.
Absolutely. And that's, I think, one of the weird things about this year and the impact that COVID has had on everything is that, you know, I had my solo show, I See Dead People, and I had plans for that. And then usually comedians will write a new solo show each year and tour it the next year. Yeah. And I See Dead People is the first in a trilogy on death, sex and religion. So I'm already looking at and starting to research the sexual history one. And so that's fun. And I know that that's going to take my attention and I'll grow that. But I also feel like I See Dead People hasn't had its full run yet. So I'm considering, do I perform two shows at the festivals next year? And that would be insane from a workload perspective. But I feel like now is the time to write about sexual history. I also got a little bit concerned that my show, I See Dead People, was happening and now we have a pandemic. And so is it a little bit off taste to go, look at all the dead bodies, bring me your corpses? But the show itself was about the four ways people have gotten rid of dead bodies across history and how we do it now and how we might do it in the future. And so, I mean, there's infinite variation across all cultures, but essentially there's only four methods. And there's actually quite a lot of interest in death care and death culture, I guess, since the pandemic started. So I won't put it to bed just yet.
Oh, I think there's certainly a space for that, and especially if you haven't had the opportunity to give it its full course like you initially planned, that'll be your decision to make, but from the outside, it's certainly something that would be, I think a lot of people would find value in, especially if they haven't had the chance to see the show yet as well. And I think also, of course, like people are going to be more, there's going to be more interest, especially in the last few months of how the world's completely been turned upside down. But personally for myself, I've always found a fascination in that space. And it's that unknown of just, and the taboo around it as well, where it's just something that generally in day-to-day life we don't often talk about because it's something that everyone is scared of creates some sort of mystique, dark mystique around it as well. And I've had a, I can't remember her name. Of course I can. Emma J. Holmes, that is a death care professional and works in a funeral home in Queensland. And she's incredible. Mm-hmm. And just listening to her, the way that she talks and just takes on death, and it blows my mind because she's so upbeat and carefree and loves it. And the perception that she has on the whole thing is just completely different to your everyday person. And so that mixed in with all the other people that work in these spaces and around death in general, it's incredible. So I think, just my opinion, throwing my 2 cents or $2 worth in, I think you should keep going. Definitely.
Yeah. And I definitely will. So I do have a spin-off podcast that I'm looking at doing, which I'm super excited about. But again, it's scheduling and funding. Time and money is everything everywhere. I think it will have a good run. So potentially I'll maybe leave writing sexual history until next year and just, you know, shuffle everything back 12 months. And it's fun for me. The other thing too about the pandemic happening now is that it has the potential to enrich the show in as much as it makes it more immediate and it makes it easier to tie the past to the present. So the things that I talk about are really in people's four brains at the moment. So yeah, I think that'll be interesting. I do have some exciting news.
Yeah.
Which I can share with you now. I know we're recording this and spill the beans. Can't hold it in. I See Dead People has been programmed into the Darwin Festival this year. Darwin Festival is going ahead.
Excellent. Congratulations. So, yeah.
Thank you. Super excited. It's in August and normally Darwin Festival and Edinburgh Fringe Festival clash. So I've always wanted to perform in Darwin Festival because it's my local. And as festivals go, it is just amazing. They have the main venue is a tent called the Lighthouse and it's roofless. Just got lights as the roof. And so you go in there at sunset and there's bats flying overhead. And it's just spectacular. And just the vibe of the food and the music and everything there in Festival Park is fantastic. So, yeah, first time I've been programmed into this festival, curated festival. And, yeah, we'll see where things go from there. For me, that's just such a buzz because we haven't had a festival since COVID hit anywhere. Yeah. And it'll feel like a one step back to normal, I think.
I think it's a big thing.
It is, yeah. And I think, too, that people will want to get out and support it. Oh, the other great thing is about the Northern Territory is we're opening our borders on the 17th of July with no quarantine requirements. So maybe we'll even have a thriving tourist population to perform to, which would be good.
Hopefully. I mean, I think no doubt that part of the country relies heavily on tourism to keep it alive and kicking.
Absolutely. And our dry season, which is your winter, is the best time of year to come here. So I think we might also catch a lot of the people from down south who would have flown overseas for a northern summer holiday and can't go there this year. Maybe they'll go, we'll check out the territory instead.
Yeah.
So come hear me tell jokes about dead people. I'm really good at it.
What a sell.
I know. We've got waterfalls and crocodiles.
Oh, we've got that stuff too. Yeah, we've got all the Northern Territory stuff as well, you know, that other stuff.
All the culture and the nature.
Yeah, but no, hey, let me talk about dead people for you.
We haven't had enough death this year.
No, just added to the list. But have you filmed any of this in the past as far as your set, or is this something that you want to still do sometime down the track?
This is my other exciting news, told you. I shot it. I did 3 nights sold out in January in Darwin and shot one of them and had just the most amazing audience that night. It was fabulous. And so I'm doing what you did with your Patreon. I'm saying in this recording that you'll be able to pre-order it on my website. Yay. I don't have it set up now, but I will have it set up by the time this goes live.
Excellent.
Yeah, so in September you'll be able to get the download on that, so pre-orders before then. And, yeah, so it's interesting because that was an early version of the show pre-pandemic. and the show will grow and have a life beyond it. But it's also just a really nice, fun glimpse into dead bodies, really.
Yeah, perfect.
Also, I talk about my cunt a bit. I probably shouldn't. I don't know whether I'll cut that bit out.
Leave it in there. Why not?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Classic. Well, I'll definitely. I wasn't expecting that one in there, but yeah, why not?
Well, you never know what to expect when you come to me. No, exactly. I like to think I put the ick in Sick and Twisted. You know, it's a bit of a weird show, but I have fun with it. And the great thing, after I did these Darwin shows, the one that I filmed, I've actually started incorporating a Q&A session into the show, because I found that afterwards people would bail me up for about an hour to tell me all their favourite dead body things and ask questions. And it's so great. And so now, with the Q&A section, a lot of people get to have their say. And even still afterwards, people come up to me and take me aside and say, I'm an introvert, so I didn't say this. There was this amazing woman who came up to me and she said, see this locket around my neck? That's my mum. Like, I've got some of her ashes here and I have her with me always. But she said also, when I travel around the world, I take her ashes to places she would have loved to go. So I've sprinkled some at Wimbledon and some at Stonehenge. Couldn't get onto the cricket pitch at Lord's. But, you know, just sprinkling her in all the bits she wanted to go. She says, it's been 22 years and still got half a bag. So
amazing.
I just love the way that people engage with their lost loved ones. So there's lots of different things. I have no idea what I want done with my dead body when I die. And it's interesting. So, you know, Phoebe, my daughter, she'll be 27 in a few weeks.
Wow.
And, yeah, I know. God, time flies. I do not feel that old. And I was saying to her that when she died, I think I'd have her cremated and turned into a diamond or a few diamonds so I could wear her around. And she's like, you can do that with hair, can't you? And I'm like, yeah, 200 grams of hair. And she's like, well, just cut my hair and then, you know, for the rest of me. And she decided what she wanted done with it, which is as it should be. But the weird thing is, it's like we're both talking about this as if she's going to predecease me, which statistically is unlikely. But it's really interesting. We find it easier to talk about the potential of her dying than we do about the potential for me dying. She's not prepared to have that conversation, which I understand and fully respect, and I can't make the decision anyway, because there's so many cool ways to – not cool ways to go, like dying's not the fun bit. What comes next, it fascinates me. this is the thing. The show that I do, it's all about corpse disposal. I've taken away the religious side of things. I didn't want to focus on what cultures believe about the afterlife. But I basically thought, well, when someone goes, you've got a pretty pressing waste disposal problem.
Yeah.
What do you do? And we tell ourselves stories to make that mechanical process more palatable. Some of them are really unpalatable.
I think one of the things that I've always been fascinated about is the, I don't know how much this is being used, but I know it was a concept that they were talking about quite a bit. I think in the US it started the eco one, where it was like this giant sort of almost like a water tower, and you were basically buried in sort of a layer of compost, and you eventually turned into compost. And as part of, you become part of the earth, and so gradually, as everything sort of decays, you sink further, and you start at the top of this giant tower and you work your way down to the bottom, and then it's sustainable.
And really, then they shovel out compost.
And then they use it for soil to plant trees and do whatever they need to do. And it's a way of sort of giving back to the earth. And you come from the earth, so to speak, and you return back to it. And I thought, what a practical and like really cool way to contribute to the larger grand scheme of things, something like
absolutely
that.
Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Absolutely. I hadn't heard about the water tower version, but human composting has just become legal in Washington State in the US, and that's the first place ever. And I wondered about it, and I'm like, how do you compost a human? Is it like a dead body newspaper vegetable scraps, dead body newspaper vegetable scraps?
Don't try this at home.
I know, right? That's not how they do it. But I still have questions about the process. Mm. But natural burial and eco-burial is a really popular modern movement. Mm. And I think it's the way of the future, really. After one of my shows in Adelaide, a woman came up to me and she and her husband run a natural burial ground in Sussex in the UK. Wow. And yes, yeah, so cool. They have barcodes on the trees, and so you plant it underneath a tree, or you plant it with a seedling and the tree grows and have a barcode there. So you just go around like with a barcode scanner to find grandma. And then, yeah, how cool is that? Like, this is grandma's tree. Yeah, I like that idea of, but I've always loved Victorian cemeteries and, you know, just the personalities on display. Yeah. Fucking hate modern cemeteries, which are designed around the cheapest way to whack it with a whippersnipper. I went to one the other week and it had a sign saying flower and ornament policy is enforced.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, fuck you. Like, we don't want these regulation headstones. It just takes all the personality and the fun out of who they were. So. Yeah,
it's a fascinating thing, because I think it's, once again, it's always been sort of traditionally a taboo subject that not even just from a cultural point of view, I think just people in general don't want to talk about it because it's, you know, it's the end of the road, so to speak. But the funny thing is that it's going to happen to everybody. And I think the more sort of put a bit of light into it to say, look, it's going to happen. So, you know, it's a way of life, and it's not a bad thing in the sense that it's something that can be avoided. So you may as well embrace it and understand and yeah, put your own spin and your own flair on it to make sure that when you aren't going to depart, I should say, that you do it in a way that's going to make sense for yourself and your family.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think for me, one of the things that drives what I do is knowing that with global population rising so phenomenally over the last 100 years, and also over the same time we've really distanced ourselves from death, as you say. We've outsourced death to hospitals, and we've outsourced the funeral home process. We're not connected. We can pretend it doesn't exist. We can put it behind closed doors and avoid it. But 100 years ago, there were 1.5 billion people on the planet, and now we've got nearly 8 billion. Mm. And all of those people are going to die in the next 100 years or less, and more will be born. And so what do you do with 8 billion dead bodies? Like, how, this is a more pressing issue than people have really considered. So, yeah, I come from that perspective of, it's not about land use, although I would love to see golf courses turned into natural cemeteries. Mm. It's just something we need to think about, if not for ourselves personally, then for our loved ones.
Oh, it's definitely a fascinating subject. I mean, something that I've thought about quite a bit, but I think, once again, like a lot of people, you don't verbalise it or don't share those discussions with other people. So it's great to have people like you that sort of, even through that comedic space, to be able to talk about these subjects and sort of just get people thinking, going, oh, yeah, like, interesting. And also to say it in a way that's not making everybody feel tense and anxious.
Yeah.
And go, oh, God, like, you know, I'm going to start stressing. It's just like, it's this sort of just shining a different light on it, a different perspective on the topic in general.
That's what I love about comedy. It gives you permission to think about things and to say the unsayable. And it's not just giving me the permission, it's actually giving the audience the permission. And that's why I love having the Q&A session at the end. And people are always a little bit shy about it. And I cover everything. Like, I talk about necrophilia. And there was one person in one of the gigs, and I always use this as the setup for the Q&A session in case people are too nervous to ask me. But this woman put her hand up and said, oh, you know that bit you did about the guy that got fucked to death? You know the bit you did about necrophilia laws? And I said, yes. And she said, that reminds me of the guy that got fucked to death by the horse. You know that one?
Oh,
and I went,
geez.
And I went, yeah? And the audience went, no. Oh. And then one night I'm doing this bit and a woman's like, wasn't it a woman that was fucked to death by a horse? And I'm like, no, I'm pretty sure it was a bloke. She's like, oh, I'm sure it was a woman. I'm like, well, there is a limit to my expertise. I don't stay up to date on who's died by being fucked to death by a horse. And so it was all about how the laws apply to necrophilia and bestiality. So if you can ask those questions, you can ask anything you like say, what you want to do with a dead body.
It's up, anything's up for grabs. Just, certainly opens it up for people to feel a little bit more relaxed about asking what they think might be a sensitive question. Jeez, you definitely make them break the ice.
I had one guy say, would you like to know about the political history of Zimbabwe? And I'm like, no. He asked it very early in the show and I said, maybe you'd like to save that for the Q&A section. And so in the end we had time and I ran with it and had a bit of fun with it. But, yeah, strange things happen in my show and I love it.
Classic. How much of death do you experience or have experienced in your line of work? Because when I look at sort of the topic of archaeology, I've just, and once again, coming from a place of ignorance, I just growing up, I always thought, well, it's either bones or pots and tools and things like that that are just shoved in the earth and that's about it. And that's what you do. And you delicately find them and that's about it. But I think obviously the space is far more broad than that. And I think just given just sort of what you just sort of lightly touched on in this conversation is that there's a hell of a lot of work involved in what you do. So I guess two-pronged question, like how much death is involved in what you do, but I guess what else does your work comprise of?
Yeah, okay, good questions. There's a reasonable amount of death, I guess you'd say. So I run a consultancy that covers the Northern Territory called In-Depth Archaeology, and all Indigenous heritage objects and places are automatically protected by the law. So if anyone wants to build a road or do drilling for mines or put in an airport or whatever, they need to check that they're not going to hit anything. And so I go out and do surveys with Aboriginal traditional owners and tell clients, stay away from this, stay away from that, move your shit. And so that's 95% of my work being I go out looking for it and tell them not to touch it and everything stays where it is. The great bit about all of that is walking on country with traditional owners and learning from them all sorts of things, not just about their archaeological heritage, but culture and landscape and plant use and all that fun stuff, art and music, and we have a cool time. And so the death side of things happens if we come across human remains in what we're doing. And in the north of Australia, there was a two-stage burial process where for the first year the body was exposed on a platform and reduced down to bones by natural activity. And then the second stage of the burial was a ceremony where the bones were sometimes decorated and wrapped in paper bark and then taken to a rock shelter on country and put in the crevices of these caves. And that was to return the spirit to country. And so often when we're out with traditional owners, we find these human remains. The paper bark deteriorates over time and the bones are more durable, so they're on display. And on rare occasions, they're sometimes threatened by disturbance. So there have been cases where feral animals have been kicking around the bones in rock shelters and things, and we do conservation projects in line with the traditional owners' wishes for how their ancestors' remains are handled. And so usually when we come across death in the workplace, it's a case of documenting and protecting it, and sometimes that needs active care, which is all done in a process of consultation and collaboration and according to regulations, and all of that side of things is quite detailed and obviously needs to be done in a rigorously transparent and accountable process. So I I find that side of the work very satisfying, because one of the things I learnt through my studies was how to, I guess you'd call it read the bones, but how to look at human remains and assess their age, their gender, their ethnic background, their height, any pathologies and that sort of thing. And so it's always up to the traditional owners how much they want to know about the remains of the individuals we've found. And sometimes they want to know everything they possibly can. And so that really draws a connection between the people of the past and the people of the present, and I like being able to help in that way. And so, yeah, it is one of the parts of the job that I enjoy the most. The rest of my job is recording rock art and stone arrangements and campsites, occupation sites, culturally modified trees, shell middens, that sort of thing, and not just Indigenous heritage but also Western heritage and Macassan and Chinese and all of the other population groups that have occupied parts of the territory at various times. And so I'm also a member of the Heritage Council up here. I advise government on how to manage stuff better and how to improve legislation and processes and that sort of thing. And yeah, just I write a lot of reports. Essentially, I'm a writer. Mm. I didn't know when I was at school that all of my deliverables would be written. But yeah, it's a fun thing. And when you get down to what's it like on a day-to-day basis, it's fucking amazing. Like, I get to go to places that are incredible and then tell other people they're not allowed to go there. So, I know, like, I get to fly in helicopters and go hiking off trail in wow. Arnhem Land and stuff. And I love it. And I just love working with Indigenous people on country and learning so much from them. So, yeah. Okay. And then, you know, I'm always fighting the good fight to improve practice and give Indigenous people more of a voice in the management of their heritage and, you know, hopefully not end up like the Rio Tintos of the world blasting 46,000-year-old sites.
Well, I wrote that down because I thought that might be something interesting to refer to, because I was going to ask that those sites that they've... Yeah, that Rio Tinto, I mean, won't go there too much of a rabbit hole, but were they similar sites to what you explained before with regards to that second stage of burial for remains for, within to the Aboriginal population where they would place them into caves? Mm-hmm. Is this a similar sort of place that was compromised by Rio Tinto or would have been potentially?
Potentially. It's very difficult to draw direct comparisons across cultures, so I'm not sure how Indigenous people in the Pilbara region cared for their dead, but obviously there was a lot of cultural heritage material there that survived, including a belt made of human hair that was 4,500 years old, and the DNA from the hair actually directly connects to the living people in the region now. And so, you know, this is thousands of years of their direct ancestors living in this place. And these are the only material connections that remain. So to lose something like that, it's irreplaceable. You know, you can't put a dollar value on it. You can't replace it. You can't say it's good enough to just pick it up and put it in a museum. Museums are great but problematic. And so, yeah, I do come across rock shelters. And so when in terms of human remains and burial practice in Western Arnhem Land, the practice was to put them onto rock shelves or crevices in the cave up high to protect them. And then sometimes the bones roll down or fall down onto the dirt deposit of the rock shelter floor. And over time, these rock shelter floor deposits build up, accumulation of more sediment, so the human remains may be there in the sediment. They're often, there's a thing we call taphonomy, which is, in my mind, it's shit happens. It's what happens after a site is formed up until when it's documented. And so that's all sorts of things like erosion and feral animal ingress and the accumulation of sediments and all that sort of thing. So things change. Nothing is ever stable. When you think about how bones react to taphonomic processes, they are quite durable, but not as durable as stone or metal. And so, and certain bones in the body are more durable than others. So your skull is thick and strong and it will survive longer than your shoulder blade. Your thigh bone is very strong as a result of weight bearing. It will last longer than your finger bones. And so as bones fall out of upper shelter areas, if they're on the surface for a time, they're at risk of being kicked around by animals, exposed to sunlight, which deteriorates bones more quickly. If they're exposed to water, they deteriorate more quickly. But if they're covered up in a stable sedimentary environment, they will last for a lot longer. And you do get dinosaur bones 64 million years ago that are mineralized. You get human remains depending on the environment of what they're in. So the tropical environment is not good for the retention of DNA. Desert environment is better for that. It's more stable. So this is where we get to body farms. Australia has a body farm that's been made legal. It's in the Blue Mountains, run by the University of Technology in Sydney.
Wow, I didn't know that. Oh, making notes now.
Yes.
Oh, I know where I'm going on the weekend.
Wait for my podcast.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, so there are 7 body farms in the US, and this is all about analysing these taphonomic processes, what happens to a body. And it's usually been done in research for recent deaths that are being investigated by detectives, so they can understand how to assess time of death or understand did the person die in spring or winter or whatever. And so that's really fascinating and important. We don't have a body farm set up in an environment that's equivalent to the wet dry tropics of the territory, so we don't know precisely how quickly human remains would degrade given certain environmental factors. But anything that's based on carbon, so anything that's been alive, can be carbon dated. And there are other dating processes that we can use to see how old something is. But yeah, getting back to Northern Territory rock shelters, we do have the earliest recorded material culture in the continent up here, so 65,000 years old. Yeah, it used to be 40,000, we thought, was how long Aboriginal people had been here. But 40,000 years was the convenient cutoff of the reliability of carbon dating. So we had to invent other ways to date materials and figure out how old they were. And so, yeah, at this stage, I think there's some pushing 80,000 years. But it's a really incredible feeling to be out in these places and know that people have lived there for tens of thousands of years. And being the first person to document these sites in these ways, I'm not the person that discovered them, obviously, because they exist, but it feels really privileged to be in there with traditional owners. And one of the things that we do is record rock art, and there's been a lot of research on rock art in the region, and chronologies have been developed that say art of this style is 4,000 years old and art of that style is 20,000 years old. So it is possible to walk into a rock shelter and go, that's been there for 5,000 years. And it's lovely. You walk in sometimes and it's like they just left. There's grindstones in the grind holes where they were grinding ochre down for painting, and stone artifacts around the place, shells from meals they've eaten. And it's peaceful.
I think that's something that most of us just can't wrap our heads around. I mean, it'd be like walking into a home that somebody's walked out of for a few hours to go down to the shops or something like that, and it's just everything's where it's
and then never came back.
And they never came back. That's right. And I think I think that's a tough thing that most of us would struggle with as far as a concept, because we are relatively disconnected from a lot of things in life. And I think for you to do what you do, you're certainly getting a completely different perspective on not only these origins of culture within our country, but also just existing as a human being, like, you know, that finite existence, but then what's left behind, and you know, even just the concept of time. I mean, if you're talking about 65,000 years, I mean, I know the number and I understand the number, but but I can't I can't fathom that
length.
You can't
picture it.
No, not at all.
I like to talk about time in terms of money. So if you think of them as dollars, and so $65 is not much. $65,000, that's a good sized pot of cash. $65 million is, that's unfathomable to me. Like, the time of dinosaurs is way too far back for me to contemplate, but the last few hundred thousand dollars of time, I can go, yeah, that's something I can wrap my head around. And so, yeah, I think for me, that whole, the story of human life and the story of human connection and the story of people living in this environment that we find ourselves in now is what's important. And I realize that Indigenous people's stories are not my stories to tell. They are their culture and I don't speak for them. But what I can do is talk to people about the value of knowing and learning these things. And what I can do is create opportunities for Indigenous people to lead conversations and management practice and that sort of thing. And that's an ongoing challenge and goal. Nothing moves quickly in the space of legislation change and practice. And I'm actually quite excited by the potential that has come from the fallout of Rio Tinto. And I think it possibly wouldn't have happened without that trigger. But the federal government has put the Joint Standing Committee for Northern Australia onto reviewing the interaction of federal heritage legislation with state heritage legislation. And that is a really good start. So it's something we haven't had for decades, if ever. And, yeah, I want to take full advantage of that in terms of building in mechanisms for Indigenous people to have more consultation prior to any of these things happening, and consultation that works on the basis of free, prior and informed consent. And then also have the ability to question and appeal decisions as more information comes around. So I think that was one of the trickiest things about the Rio Tinto situation, was that it was legal. They got the authority to disturb it under the Act. And once that was granted, Indigenous people didn't have a say.
Yeah. Whew, it's a big topic. I mean, it's the good thing about it is, I mean, with what you're doing is that, you know, you have an element of contribution to the wider subject and the wider topic, and what you've been doing for what appears to be quite a few years is just sort of bringing some awareness not only to the community but to the larger corporations as well, and be able to sort of educate people around what is in our country, what's important, and what needs to be considered when, you know, because obviously, you know, from a business perspective or a corporation perspective, it's, you know, they're creating money. And it's a money-driven motivation there, but it's to find that balance to go, look, you know, obviously you want a successful venture, but at the same time there needs to be a balance to ensure that people are protected and their culture and
absolutely.
Their backgrounds are protected as well. So it sounds like you're doing good work in your own space as well.
Thank you. I do try to contribute to win-win situations, because it's never extremes in one direction or the other. It's always shades of grey. And, yeah, and you can't even necessarily say that all Indigenous people are anti-mining because of the impact on the land, because they also have the right to use their land in whatever way they see fit for their communities now. And some of that, they need jobs and they need economic sustainability for themselves, and they find ways of working so that all of their values can be balanced in ethical projects. So, yeah, it's a very tricky balance. We work on it, and we have a lot of wins. So, yeah,
that's good. As long as it's all moving in the right direction, and just from what you said with what's recently happened. I think you can't afford not to be at least moderately optimistic about at least the direction of where it's all going. So that's good.
Exactly. Yeah, and I'll run with that as far as I can.
Yeah. Well, look. Oh, I haven't even scraped the surface. There's so many other things I was going to chat to you about. So we'll have to catch up again, and maybe next time you're in Sydney, or maybe I just need to come up to Darwin and just...
Yeah, come to Darwin. You'll love it.
Alrighty, very, very good. KCMonica.com is a place to go for KC Martin Stone. A little bit confusing, but you can go to andydowling.net or andysocial.net, and I'll have all the links in the show notes for this episode. And of course, KC's on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can search for KC Martin Stone and you'll be able to find her on there. As with all the guests that have been on the podcast, and I always say this, make sure you reach out to KC and everybody who's been on the Andy Social podcast to date and let them know what you thought. Go and say hello and let them know the Andy Social crowd has been listening. Very, very good. Now, before we wrap it up, as I've been mentioning at the beginning of a lot of the previous podcast episodes over the past several weeks, I am on Patreon. That's right, patreon.com/AndyDowling. It's a great little thing that I've started. It's been a massive help for the podcast. Already have 20 legends over there already, and I've got a goal that I'm trying to reach at the moment where I will eventually up the ante for this podcast to go to 2 guests per week. So hopefully I will get that soon, because I've got a lot of people I need to talk to, and the quicker I can get this podcast out means the quicker I can do these recordings with people. So yeah, so jump on over if you want to support. Support starts from only $1 a month. Dirt cheap. I mean, that's US dollars, but you know, it may as well be $1. And there's additional tiers there where you can get access to exclusive things such as little weekly podcast episodes as well. I've got another goal which I haven't shared just yet, but I will share it in due course once we get up to 50 supporters on Patreon. It may involve another podcast that I'm going to do. So stay tuned for that one. But it's been a lot of fun. And the people that have already jumped on so far have been a huge, huge help to keeping this podcast sustainable and keeping me driven and motivated as well. So a few people I must say thank you to. These are people that are part of my social circle tier. These are the guys who are the main, I guess, the significant contributors to the podcast on Patreon. These are the guys who throw the big bucks at me. So we've got Andrew from Perth, Mick G from Sydney, Ash from Deniliquin, Dan from Dapto, Rod from Raleigh in North Carolina, Saul from Oxford in the UK, Patrick from Canberra, Liam from Brisbane, and Chris from Sydney. Thank you so much, folks. Absolute legends. And just, yeah, you guys know what it's like, because I always crap on about it over in Patreon. It's super, super cool. So if you feel like joining, I think it's a lot of fun, but hey, I'm pretty biased. But go over to patreon.com/AndyDowling and check it all out. Now, if you don't want to do that, you can support the podcast by just listening to me crap on in these outros. Thank you very much. And you can also do a bit of social media love and share these episodes around and help us continue to build the audience. It's been great this year since relaunching the beginning of the year in Feb with Andrew Farris from INXS was the first episode to kick off this year. And it's just been going from strength to strength. Just really, really happy with you guys just participating and being a part of this podcast. Has been super cool and continuing to grow, which is great. So there we go. More episodes to come. I've got another musician, an international musician next week, another lady as well. I've got a balance it out a little bit. And really looking forward to sharing that one with you all. So until next week, folks, take care and ta-ta. Larry, please.